Good evening. Shabbat Shalom. Good Sabbath to you. Some of you will be hearing this perhaps later tonight or during the daytime on the Sabbath. So if you're listening to this, keep in mind that at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday, as we call it in English, we'll have a webcast, a live webcast. That'll be 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll do the same on the last holy day, on the eighth day, the last annual holy day. On the eighth day, which is Tuesday, we'll also have a 3 p.m. service. And then on Sunday, Monday, we'll do our early bird studies, you know, at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on Sunday and on Monday. So we've been getting some messages. We've been getting input from people who've been hearing in California, in Connecticut, in Oregon. We're certainly grateful to all of you for letting us know that you're listening. And we've been getting communications from feastgoers in different parts of the world. We got something from Costa Rica, from Thailand. We heard from a group in Utah. We heard from a group in Indiana. We heard from a group in Sri Lanka. So people are checking in, as you might say, letting us know that they're keeping this festival. So if you're keeping this festival, we wish you well. And if you happen to be hearing this and didn't keep the festival, then this gives you an opportunity to think about what we're saying and maybe next year observe the festival with us or with whomever. I'd like to turn, first of all, to 2 Corinthians 5 just to get some imagery here. I'm calling this talk Walking with Wisdom. Walking with Wisdom. You know, you don't want to be foolish. You want to be wise in whatever you do. Foolishness can really hurt you. It can hurt other people. You want to be wise. And, of course, wisdom often comes with age and experience. The school of hard knocks. But at the same time, when we are younger, if we're smart, we'll consult people who have experience, older people, and not try to repeat the same mistakes. And when we're older, we'll try to remember lessons from the past and not repeat the same mistakes, and also share what we have learned with others if they're willing to listen. But it's important to be wise. And frankly, there is a shortcut to wisdom, because think of it this way. In fiction, in popular culture, there's this 800-year-old talking toad. And he's lived so many centuries that he's very wise. And he trains people. And part of his experience is having lived so long. That's part of, you know, the one of the assets that he has. And obviously, if you could be trained by this 800-year-old teacher, you know, you'd certainly want to have the opportunity to have this kind of training. It's a special opportunity. Well, look at this now in the real world. In the real world, we have God who's lived forever and who created the entire universe, who knows how everything works, including the human mind and the human heart, as we say. And he has written down wise thoughts for us, wise advice for us, where we, even at a young age, can look into the words and we can get a leg up. So it's so foolish to not pay attention to that and not study it and think about it and discuss it when it's here for us. So in 2 Corinthians 5:7, jumping into the middle of a thought, Paul says that we look forward to the future, for we walk in faith, not by sight. We don't see now what we're going to have in store for us, but we believe it, we trust God, and so we walk in faith, not by sight. It's not blind faith, though. You know, we do have our history behind us. We do have our own lives and experiences. So we do have certain understanding, so that there is faith, but not, it is not a blind faith, but there is faith obviously involved in our life. But our life here is compared to a walk. We're walking. We're going in a certain direction. You know, we talk about the Christian walk. And so we're walking. We're going. And as you know, in the Bible, it speaks about a couple of great figures in ancient times who walked with God. And so in that sense, they had a special life, a blessed life, because they walked with God. And walking with God, of course, meant that they were gaining great wisdom from Him, divine wisdom. So we want to walk with wisdom. Now, this time of year is a time to think about wisdom and wisdom literature in the Bible. At this season of the year, when people were feasting and were having their most enjoyable physical time, no holds barred in a way, other than, of course, what would be immoral. But we can just do whatever we want to do in the physical sense this time of year. And so it gives us the opportunity to reflect on this physical life and to reflect on what really is important. And you understand that the point of the feast is that after a while you begin to realize that the physical things you're doing are not where it's at. Really where it's at, to use that kind of a phrase, is the character that you're building. You can't take any of these physical things with you. The only thing that you take with you is your character. And if you look at life, you know, just from the point of view of having value in your life, the Greek philosopher Socrates said that the unexamined life was not worth living. He felt that if you're really going to get something out of life, you need to think about what you're doing and why you're doing it, what you've done, what you're going to do, and so forth. And if you really think about the discipline of ethics, in order for humanity to live the best life it could possibly live, and in order to live that life in the greatest quality, people would need to be ethical. An ethical society is going to survive, and it's also going to survive not as a dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest jungle environment, but in a more human environment where people can reach their proper potential. If everybody is treating everybody else ethically, each person can truly develop his potential, which means the human race is going to advance farther along toward the potential that it could achieve, toward the greatness that it could achieve. So being ethical, if nothing else, not only means that you have died it with a clear conscience, but it means you have advanced humanity, human civilization, if you've been ethical. Now, this just taking aside, forgetting the supernatural side of it. So this time of year, as I said, when people are to be feasting, they're also to be getting the lesson that the physical is temporary, you know, just as we live in temporary dwellings. And that ultimately what counts is character. And so if you go to Deuteronomy 14, it says here that you shall eat, and you shall eat before the Eternal your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. And I've been eating well this week. Hope that you've been. Where in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and in your flocks. Why? That you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. You know, you're setting, as you set aside for the festival and you keep the festival, you know, it keeps you in a proper frame of mind. You know, you're having your greatest occasions of joy in times that are God-centered, rather than, you know, developing our own holidays to honor whatever and who, and, you know, and to honor whomever. You know, we're actually honoring God during these festivals, and they are God-centered. And so we are developing character and keeping them properly. And the book of Ecclesiastes, as I said, is the festival scroll that this time of year has been read in the Jewish community, because it pictures a person who did it all physically, had every possible physical pleasure, and then realized ultimately at the end of his life that it was all vanity, you know, hevel. It was like a puff of smoke. And ultimately, you know, that what counts is character. He did finally learn that lesson towards the end of his life and recorded it for us. So tonight I want to talk about wisdom and to give some wise sayings, not my sayings, but biblical sayings, so you can be sure that they are wise sayings, because they're not coming from me. I'm reading them out of the Bible. But I'm reading from the wisdom literature. I'm reading from that genre of literature which you could call the wisdom literature. In Hebrew, the word is chokhmah, the most common word for wisdom, and in Greek, sophia, which gives us, of course, a name. Some people even have the name wisdom, some women, Sophia. First of all, this time of year at the Festival of Tabernacles, one of the things you focus on and think about is family. And you begin to understand that really that is the most critical area of life, is your family, that really your greatest joys are found in that kind of an environment, in a family environment. If you're always just constantly trying to, you know, go here, go there, do this, do that, and you're neglecting, you know, let's say your hearth, you know, your core, you're really missing out. Because it's like I was recently telling my wife, you know, after when you've lived with somebody for years, it's interesting the appreciation that develops, over time of a spouse. It grows over time as years go by, and you think, look, I've spent my life with this particular person, and for that reason, my life's been so much better, you know, than it might have been. You know, and you really tend to appreciate your spouse after decades, you know, together like that, even more so than, you know, obviously there's that initial attraction that brought you together, but it grows over time. The appreciation grows over time. And during this time of year, you know, couples should have that focus as part of what they're doing this time of the year. You know, the Bible does have a lot to say about, you know, that's about the romantic side of marriage, you might say the sexual side of marriage. That is part of Scripture. I wanted to read just one brief passage because we're talking here, when we talk about wise writings of wisdom, we're talking here about Solomon. And the fact that he had such great wisdom, but he blew it because he didn't apply his wisdom. You know, knowledge is having enough data. Understanding is being able to relate the data, so that you know what to do with the data. But wisdom is, you know, applying application. You know, as knowing what to do with the data. Knowledge is relating one fact to another, and wisdom is doing, you know, knowing what to do with the facts, applying them. And now Solomon knew what to do. You know, he had wisdom, he had knowledge, he had understanding, he even had wisdom. But unfortunately, he thought that he was somehow an exception. Perhaps because he was who he was, you know, certain things didn't apply to him. He was like a special case, which he is not, you know, which he was not. You know, none of us is in that sense a special case. All of us are mere humans, and we have the same vulnerability as any other human. And Solomon unfortunately had to learn that lesson the hard way. Now, traditionally, he wrote Song of Solomon in his youth, you know, which is a very, you know, a collection of romantic, of erotic, you know, poetry. And he wrote then later on the book of Proverbs, collecting wisdom from all around the world, putting it in a collection that so we could have it today, the greatest wisdom of all those centuries and all those areas, you know, and brought together for us. And then finally, at the end of his life, wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, you know, where he drew some very critical conclusions towards the end. So let's look first at the Song of Solomon and the positive relationship here of husband to wife, you know, and the romantic relationship that should be there. You know, just briefly comment on that. This is in Song of Solomon 7 in verse 6. Here the husband is speaking to the wife. He says, "How fair and how pleasant you are." This is Song of Solomon 7:6. "O love, with your delights. This stature of yours is like a palm tree, and your breasts like its clusters. I said, I will go up to the palm tree. I will take hold of its branches. Let now your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine." So rather graphic. It's very poetic, but also in some ways rather graphic about the physical intimacy between husband and wife. And that should be certainly, you know, very much a part of what happens at these festivals. There is also, of course, as we understand from Solomon and what he wrote in Ecclesiastes towards the end of his life, a proper time for this kind of thing, and, you know, and a time to abstain from this kind of thing. You know, this is a proper relationship between a married couple, and, you know, it is inappropriate otherwise. And If you go to Ecclesiastes, which, as I said, was, you know, Song of Solomon was probably written early in his life. Song of Solomon and Ecclesiastes written later, at towards the end of his life. If you go to Ecclesiastes, the third chapter, and you go to verse 5. Well, let's start in the beginning of the third chapter. It says, "To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven." You know, so there's a time to do certain things, a time not to do certain things. And it says in verse 5, there's a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. So for a married couple, that is their time. They should be, you know, spending a lot of time embracing. On the other hand, people who are single, that's the time to refrain from embracing. You know, so there's a time and a place for appropriate behavior. Now, while I'm in the book of Ecclesiastes and talking about the importance of home and family, I want to turn to the ninth chapter. There are certain basic truths that we learn in life if we allow ourselves, you know, to learn that lesson. And a lot of them are found here in Ecclesiastes 9, and I want to go there now. As I said, this book would be read on this day, on the Sabbath day, during the Festival of Tabernacles in synagogues around the world. Now, if the Festival of Tabernacles begins on the Sabbath, they'll wait and read this book on the eighth day because they want to celebrate the feast for a while before they read the book. Because it's best read once you've actually been feasting for a period of time. Well, we have been feasting for a period of time. We're now, this is what, the fourth day of the festival. So, right? So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. This is actually, we're into the fifth day now. The Sabbath now has begun, so we're in the fifth day of the festival. So certainly it's appropriate now to get into this book. In Ecclesiastes 9, "For I considered all this in my heart so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their work are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them." You know, so ultimately, of course, we don't really control our lives. We, you know, we may, in one sense, we, you know, we do. We do have a choice in terms of character, you know, and whether we're going to, choose to be evil or to be good. But, you know, human beings ultimately are not, you know, we really are not in charge of our lives in that sense, because, you know, God is all powerful, and we have these forces that we deal with, you know, nature that we deal with, and so on, and we have our own mortality that we deal with. You know, we can at least make choices and respond, but we really don't ultimately, you know, we aren't really ultimately, don't ultimately control the details. But it goes and says, "All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and to the good, the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath as he who fears an oath." What he's saying is that you can get very cynical, because you see that, well, when all is said and done, good people, you know, get sick and bad people get sick. Good people die, bad people die. Good people have accidents, bad people have accidents. And on it goes. And so you would say to yourself, well, what difference does it all make? You know, and that's not the point. The point is not what, you know, that we're trying to sort of gain some advantage over somebody else by how we're living. The stakes are higher than that. The stakes are eternal. The stakes, as I said, are not only for ourselves but for all humankind. But on one level, you could look around and you could see, you know, well, one thing happens to one person, one thing happens to another person, and then he goes on. He says, "There is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead." You know. Now, when you read the book of Ecclesiastes, you have to put the whole book together. You can take a couple of verses out of context and put that as maybe a bumper sticker, as some people do. You know, but that's not the point of the book. The point of the book is, this is what life would be if we didn't take into account, you know, the higher purpose. You know, but if you just want to think on a certain cynical level, you know, you know that's the conclusion that you can draw. Life is really tough, and then you die. You know, there's a bumper sticker like that, except it's a little more vulgar than what I said. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. You know, while there's life, there's hope. You know, at least while you're alive, you could you know, think, you could always hope for something better. But for a living dog is better than a dead lion. You know, which we understand. You know, a lion, you know, somebody who's dead has no more consciousness, so there's no more hope involved. While you're alive, you're hoping. When you're dead, there's no more hope. So even a living dog is, in that sense, better than a dead lion. You know, that's a rather obvious thing. For the living know that they will die. At least they know that much. But the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Now, this is frankly the reality. You know, the Bible does not teach that human beings are immortal. That the immortality of the soul is not a biblical doctrine. The biblical doctrine, of course, is that God will resurrect the dead according to a plan that he has. And that is our hope, the resurrection. You know, we are not immortal. Because most religions teach the immortality of the soul, they have difficulty with some of these passages. For example, the Old Living Bible, if you own one, has a footnote to try to contradict verse 5. Well, you know, like they know better, like they know more than the Bible. Kind of odd. But if you read the footnote, it's really a strange footnote. There's like they're trying to contradict the scripture instead of just trying to, you know, go with the flow. They're trying to attack it because it goes against traditional belief. Anyway, also their love, their hatred, and their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. In other words, as history goes on, they've had their chance, they're gone. We understand there's more to it than that, that there is a resurrection. But as far as, you know, as history goes on, once you die, you know, as they say, you're dead a long time. But of course, eventually, there does come the resurrection, and that is explained in other verses. So having that in mind, you know, make the best of this life, but remember that your real joy comes in the most basic things, that God designed life so that the most basic joys are the ones that really are long-lasting and beneficial. You know, it's nice to be able to go to shows and go to concerts and go to sporting events or whatever, you know, as we say, whatever floats your boat, whatever turns you on. But your basic joys are really within home and family. He says, go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. In other words, if you've put in a good day's work, you know, an honest day's work, you know, you could be satisfied with that. You've done your share, you know. You've put in your honest day's work. So go ahead and have a good meal, drink wine, enjoy these things that God has given you to enjoy. Let your garments always be white, and let your heart your head lack no oil. You know, go ahead and enjoy what you can, you know, and benefit from your work. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which she has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. So, in other words, that is really much more beneficial. Your relationship with your wife is far more beneficial than a lot of these other things that, you know, you're spending time with. So the two of you spending time with each other in that relationship is far more important than these other ones. But he goes on to say, if you are going to work, then do a good job. Because, you know, why not? Why shouldn't you? You know, you're not going to accomplish anything after you're gone. So while you're here, you know, get something accomplished. That doesn't mean that you obsess over it, but you should realize that you want to accomplish something while you can, because you're not going to accomplish anything when you're dead. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Now, it doesn't say all your might. It does, you know, you're not obsessed, but, you know, do a good job when you have a job to do. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave where you're going. So he says, okay, you understand that when you're dead, you're dead. So therefore, while you're alive, accomplish something. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. This is just the reality. Life isn't always fair. And eventually you come to realize that people don't always get immediately what's coming to them. Now, maybe in the long run, you could say, obviously, there is a certain justice that works. You know, what goes around comes around. That principle is there. But in a given situation, things don't always work out the way they should in a moral sense. You know, sometimes the bad guy does win, at least temporarily. Now, ultimately, he's not going to win, but temporarily he might. And so be aware of that. There's time and there's chance. For a man also does not know his time, like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare. So the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. You know, we are all mortal and we don't know how long we have to live. This is just a reality that we deal with. This wisdom I have also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it, besieged it, and built great snares around it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that same poor man. You know, there are a lot of unsung heroes in history, a lot of people who were famous for a period of time whose names are barely known now. And that's just, you know, that, again, that's what happens. But nevertheless, they at least have accomplished something positive. Then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. You know, we tend to think that because people are materially better off, that they're wiser people. That's not necessarily the case. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard, rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. When you hear something wise, take it into account. Respond to it. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. So it's better to enter into life wisely, to act wisely. And one sinner can really, as we know, destroy a lot of good. You know, one bad apple, as we say, can spoil the whole bunch. It's an unfortunate truth. You know, so we certainly want to be careful about that because, you know, we want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And we want to avoid, you know, those who would be causing problems. Now, in conclusion then, in Ecclesiastes 12, he finally goes on to say, at the end of the book, in verse 11, the words of the wise are like goads, and words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. So, all this collection of books we have before us here is really inspired by, you know, by one great teacher. God inspired these various authors because, you know, he wants people to respond. So he gives us different kinds of books, different styles of writing, different personalities that are in the Bible. You might identify more with one or more with another. And we have all of these. We have poetry. We have prophecy. We have narratives. You know, we have all kinds of material here. We have different languages used and all the rest of it. But one shepherd inspiring this material. And all of it, of course, put together is you might say a smorgasbord of delights for us to help us live better. And he goes on to say, and further, my son, be admonished by these. In other words, we should pay attention to these words of wisdom. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. You know, you go to any bookstore nowadays, there's bookstores that are called, what, acres of books, books a million, you know. So there's plenty of books out there, and you could just study and study and study. In fact, that's what I've spent a lot of my life doing, and I'm exhausted. No, but I have spent a lot of my life studying. I've got a lot of degrees after my name. You know, but the point is, you know, if we all were more familiar with this book, we would have so much of an advantage on other people, however much they may know. Because I understand somebody may know a lot more physics than I know, a lot more auto mechanics than I know, or whatever it is. But just on how to live, if I really know what's in this book, I'll have a tremendous advantage on how to live, which is ultimately the most important thing. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. You know, so we are ultimately responsible. We are ultimately accountable for our life and for the character that we either have built or have not built. You know, we are going to have to answer for that. Everybody will. Now, I was actually going to, after this, go into quite a few passages from Proverbs, but I see here that I've already taken quite a bit of time just with, you know, with this material here. So let me just, though, jump into Proverbs just a little, and then I want to go to a New Testament wisdom book, which is similar to Proverbs. Today I was trying to focus on wisdom, you know, particularly Solomonic wisdom, and then to go from there to New Testament wisdom. And of course also to be giving, you know, as we say, food in due season. The book of Ecclesiastes is a book to be studied at this time of year. But I did want to get into Proverbs somewhat. So let me just, do one, section of Proverbs. There's so many things I could do, and maybe later on in the feast I'll go back to it, or certainly later on in the year I plan to. But let's just take a look at one particular proverb. He's talking here about laziness and about not being a self-starter, not being able to motivate oneself. And one of the reasons why managers make so much more money than people who simply are there to do the job, the people who have to supervise them, they make a lot more money normally. It's because most of us can't seem to work without that kind of supervision. Most people are not self-starters. They can't get going on their own. And so they tend to need the supervision. And so, you know, managers are very important in a company, and they're normally compensated much better than just the average employee. And so, Proverbs talks about this. In Proverbs 6 and verse 6, he says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which, having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest." You know, an ant, the lowest of creatures, this insect, just, you know, so diligently goes about its business and just does what has to be done. You know, automatically, God has just built that into the ant. But unfortunately, with people, you know, we have to motivate ourselves and push ourselves to do the right thing. And often we don't. And so that's one reason why, as I said, we tend to need more supervision. We need to have people to give us the swift jab in the ribs or the swift kick in the rear, you know, to get us going. If people were better motivated, then there wouldn't be as much need for managers and supervisors. And if people weren't so indulgent and lazy, you know, the world would accomplish a lot more. You know, so as I said before, that we don't want to be obsessed with things outside of the basic family relationship. If we're constantly in what we call the rat race, you know, if we're constantly pushing to get better, you know, get more and more and more and more, well, why do we want it? If we destroy, you know, our relationships in the process, it's not worth it. You know, so we have to have our priorities. You know, we don't want to be workaholics and avaricious and greedy. But on the other hand, we don't want to be lazy. You know, we don't want people who, you know, to, for example, to walk into our home or walk into our yard and think, you know, what kind of concern does this person have for other people or for the neighborhood and so on? You know, what kind of laziness is here? How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. You know, so it's like almost like stealing from yourself if you're a lazy person, because you're just not going to have as much as somebody else simply because you didn't work hard enough. So there's that balance. We don't want to be workaholics, but we don't want to be lazy either. We want to be able to be self-starters. Now, there's so much else in this book, so much wisdom in this book, and I was going to go into it at length, but people here are literally exhausted. You know, it's an evening study here. And so before everybody just conks out on me here, I want to conclude in a reasonable amount of time. So I do want to go to yet another proverb, but one that's going to be a segue into how I want to conclude. So if you go to Proverbs 25, you know, actions speak louder than words. We can talk a good fight, but then not actually do what we say. And of course, if you say one thing and do another, do the opposite, of course, that's hypocrisy. But on the other hand, words can be used to help people or to hurt people. And one way to really encourage people is through our words. And one way to really hurt people is through our words. And that is a very basic truth that we need to consider at this time of year. As you know, one thing that happens this time of year is that we're interacting with family and with brethren. And we're also interacting with people as we experience the festival, as we go to restaurants, as we go to tourist attractions and so on. We're interacting with people. We want to make sure that our words are positive and encouraging and not hurtful. And that should be the case all year, for that matter. In Proverbs 25:11, it says, "A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in settings of silver." So just the right word at the right time can really, really make a difference, can really be helpful. And so we want to be that way in our words. And we don't want our words to be hurtful. We want our words to be encouraging and helpful. So with that in mind, I'd like to go to the book of James. The book of James is a book of Proverbs for the New Testament. Yaakov, or Jacob, is the Hebrew version of this name. It comes down to us as James. He, of course, was one of the brothers of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ had brothers and sisters, and James was one of them. And in James 1 and verse 5, he tells us that we should seek wisdom. And that's one of the reasons he wrote the book. In James 1 and verse 5, he says, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him." So one thing we should pray for is wisdom, because we really do need it. And as I said, if we pray for it and we look, you know, and we study the Bible, we in effect can be wise beyond our years. We can have a lot more wisdom than normally a person our age would have, because wisdom often usually comes with age and experience. But wisdom can also come through prayer and study. Now, speaking of prayer and study, let's do some studying now. And I'm talking about here the power of words. And I want to go to James 3 as I conclude this brief talk on walking with wisdom. That was the name of this talk, walking with wisdom, that we should live our lives wisely, you know, looking to God for wisdom. And in James 3, he says, "My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we will receive the stricter judgment." So obviously, we have to be careful if we're going to publicly teach that we live up to what we're saying. "For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able to also to bridle the whole body." You know, but of course there aren't any really perfect people. "Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body." You know, a little twisting of the bit and the horse will go one way, or the horse will go another way. A very powerful animal, and yet we can control the horse. "Look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires." You know, a little turning of that rudder and the ship can go one direction or another, a huge ship. "Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things." The little tongue, you know, is not as impressive as the arm, you know, or the leg, the shoulder. You know, not as impressive, but it has such power. It kind of reminds me, you know, there was a boarding house and people were sitting at the table eating and somebody stretched out his hand to the middle of the table and grabbed something, and the other person was shocked at his bad manners, and he said to him, "You have a tongue, haven't you?" He said, "Yeah, but I can reach farther with my hand." But, you know, if the hand, the arms are impressive, the legs are impressive, the tongue is small, but it has such power. "Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles." You know, just the wrong word at the wrong time can cause so much harm. "And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell." So it's a rather severe statement here that is made. "For every kind of beast and bird of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind." We've seen that. We've seen people controlling animals that we would think would be normally very wild animals. But yet nobody seems to be able to control his tongue. "But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison." Now obviously it shouldn't be that way. And we see other verses in the Bible that show us it doesn't have to be that way. Words can be very inspiring and very encouraging, and all of us have been encouraged and inspired by the right word. And all of us, though, have been also hurt by the wrong words. And so we need to be watching what we say. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. A lot of people think they're very religious and act like it, and then they're vicious in the way they talk about other people. Well, you know, is that appropriate? Obviously not. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. You know, we should be consistent. And consistently positive, you know, good, consistently right, not vicious. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? In other words, if there's a lot of bitterness in you, then that means that's something you need to deal with. Yeah, you may be saying a lot of positive things, but if you say a lot of bitter things, that means that you've got a problem. Your heart is a mixed bag and needs to be more positive. Verse 12. Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring yields both salt water and fresh. So in other words, if you are spewing out with a lot of garbage, you may say good things as well, but the fact that you're spewing out with so much garbage indicates that you've got a problem you've got to overcome. There's too much garbage inside. We used to talk about, you know, G-I-G-O, GIGO, or JIGO, you know, garbage in, garbage out. If a lot of garbage is coming out, then, you know, we've got to watch for the garbage inside. Now, I can tell you, I've dealt with a lot of people in the field of religion. And, of course, people in the field of religion are supposed to be, you know, ethical people, good people. Not perfect people, but at least, you know, generally good people. And yet I have sometimes been around them and heard them say the kind of things that they shouldn't say. And it's not just a slip of the tongue. You know, they've said things that indicate that there are problems there. Now, you know, I never had to go any further. I never had to try to dig. Not that it was any of my business either, but I never had to dig in and try to find out, well, what's wrong? Or what, you know, once I was around them and heard the way they were speaking, that's all I had to know. And you know what? Over the years, I would learn more, because that seems to be the way it happens. You know, at least in my life, when I have suspected people have fallen far short, usually I have that confirmed. Unfortunately, later on, I finally it does come out. You know, and I begin to hear about that person in certain ways, and I'm, yeah, that's right. And you know, and then when I hear, I have to say I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised because the indication was there. You know, I tell my children a story that I learned in the yeshiva many years ago. Let's turn to Matthew 12 while I'm telling this story. You know, I tell my children this story. As I said, I learned it in the yeshiva many years ago as a young rabbinical student. If you see a drawer and you see, a little sock sticking out of the drawer or a sleeve sticking out of the drawer or something like that, what is that? You know, what does that mean? That things aren't all just neatly put in place in the drawer. So you don't have to open the drawer wide and see the mess. All you have to see is that little bit sticking out, and you know the mess that is there. And, you know, so that is the point. You know, when you're dealing with people who are supposed to be religious people, you know, the way they, you know, you hear them speaking and how they're talking, and you know what kind of people they are. You don't have to delve any further. And you, sooner or later, you're going to find out anyway. But you don't need to then delve into it. You know enough. You know enough, and you can make that evaluation. You can therefore be careful of such people. I'd like to go to Matthew 12 and verse 34. You know, here is the principle. Matthew 12:34. Christ is condemning the religious leaders of his day, who were posing as one thing, but yet were acting very differently. And he says to them, brood of vipers. Now, he has a right to say that. He's Jesus Christ. You know, but he was at this point, you know, being very graphic with them, very direct. Brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. You know, what is inside is what eventually comes out. So with that in mind, of course, we want to make sure that we are filling our hearts and minds with what is positive. So that's what we'll come out with. you know, that our motivation is a positive one, so that when we speak, in fact, it will be to the edification of people, the upbuilding of people. And that this is a time of year to think about that. When we're not going to do our daily jobs, when we're in effect on a break, you know, we can kind of take a moment and take the time to think about our own thoughts and motivations and how it's reflected in what we say. And so to conclude, I'd like to go to Colossians 4. So walking with wisdom, one of the elements of walking with wisdom is, you know, watching how we use words and how we interact with, how we communicate with other people, that we are communicating in a way that is edifying and constructive. And this is one of the lessons of this time of the year. It's a time of year when we're together with people of like mind, and we're in reinforcing the positive side. And this is the way it should be all year. And even when we're not, you know, with people you know, who are of like mind, we can do as best we can to be a positive influence wherever we are. And in Colossians 4 and verse 6, Colossians 4 and verse 6, we know from studying the Bible that salt is used symbolically. Salt is a cleanser. Salt is a preservative, and salt is also a flavor enhancer. And this is what God's word, you know, should do. God's word should preserve our character. It should cleanse our character, and it should also enhance, you know, enrich our character. And so we are called in the Bible by Jesus Christ. We Christians are called the salt of the earth. So we should really, in that sense, be the salt of the earth. We should be a force for cleansing the earth, a force for preserving the earth, because God will want to preserve the world because of His church, as we know. And we will also should also be a force for enhancing, you know, edifying and enriching the earth, making it more flavorful, tasteful. And in Colossians 4 and verse 6, it says, "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one." So let's look to the Bible for wisdom in our conduct, in our thoughts, in our actions, and in our words. And let's make it a point in this coming year to be very aware of what we're saying and how we're saying it, that we might be very positive, very encouraging, and enriching, and stabilizing in the way we deal with others. Let's walk with wisdom then throughout the rest of this festival, through the eighth day, through this weekly Sabbath that we're enjoying now, and of course throughout the year and throughout our lives. Well, I'm grateful for those of you who are here listening and those who will be hearing this later, whenever you decide to download it and listen. And thanks again for those who are communicating with us and letting us know that you're keeping this festival or that you're out there listening to these messages. We certainly are wish you a wonderful Sabbath, a wonderful conclusion of this Festival of Tabernacles. Remember also that if you want to listen to us live, we'll be webcasting at 3 p.m. on Saturday. What's the actual date of that on the Roman calendar? I'm losing track of dates. Yes. Okay, tomorrow we'll be webcasting at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, October 18th. In the meantime, Chag Sameach, Happy Festival, Shabbat Shalom, peaceful Sabbath to you, and all the best to you and yours.